it's like a completely different day than when I was up here like 10 minutes ago. It was all dark in here, and we were all kind of sleepy. Now the sun's out. Still look a little sleepy, but the sun's out, and it's brightened up a little bit. I'm going to begin by talking about a man named Robin Mark. Robin Mark was 1994. About where you were in 1994. It was the end of the year, and he was watching the television, and he was watching one of those TV shows that does the year in review. And he's looking back at 1994 and all the events of 1994. And it was interesting to go back this week and think a little bit about all the things that happened in 1994. It was a year that Nancy Kerrigan got smoked by Tonya Harding and her cronies, which now all of you know about because it's a movie. So even if you're not old enough to remember that, you remember it because of the movie. That was 1994. I can still remember, this will be hard for you to picture, but the year, the day I got home from, Robin Mark didn't know this, but I'm filling this in for you. The day after school was out that summer, I went home and I shaved my head all the way with a razor. So I'll let you picture that for a minute because it's a little bit going on there. The reason that's relevant is because I remember, Ben, I had soccer camp that summer, and I got burned so bad, and I can remember watching, and 1994 was the year that O.J. Simpson was in the white Bronco, and I remember that forever because I was picking skin out of my hair because I had gotten sunburned so bad, and my hair was starting to grow back, and so, yeah, so that was my memory looking back in 1994 this week. I was like, oh yeah, I remember that clearly. So you had Nancy Kerrigan and Tonya Harding. You had O.J. Simpson going on. It was the year they opened Jacobs Field in Cleveland. It was the year the Indians were going to play the Reds in the World Series, Kurt. That was the year. The Reds were in first place. The Indians were a game out, and they had to strike that year. And so there was no World Series. They didn't have it. Actually, the Montreal Expos were probably going to win it all that year. They were just loaded with talent. And so Robin Mark is just watching all these things unwind. And none of those things were all that significant to him. What you may remember if you were alive, I was a teenager, but I still remember all the news coverage from Africa. And you remember 1994 is when Rwanda had just a horrific genocide. And the Hutus and the Tutsis, I always get those two rival clans mixed up. They estimate that it's somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million people were killed that year. And Robin Mark is watching this on the television, and he's a Christian. And he's just wrestling with a world that God would allow 1 million people to kill each other. And just letting that sink in, it was aching his soul. You know, you hear all, and that was 20 years ago. Now you have just this constant media feed. And it's easy to do that, isn't it? Like, it's easy to just get caught up in all the negative things that are happening in the world. And it's easy as a Christian to just sometimes have a lot of doubts and questions about, is God really involved here? Like, is God really allowing these things to happen? I mean, I was at church Sunday, and we sang about this omnipotent God who's all-powerful and all-knowing. And you got to look at the world, and I think, and he's good, right? What kind of good God would allow these things to happen? And I think it's something we all wrestle with. And as Robin Mark watched the events from that year, and those of us who have lived all the years since that, probably all had moments where we've asked ourselves the question, is God really there? Mass murders, mass shootings, serial rapists, gun violence, wars, abortion. I mean, you just go on and on and on. And let's go back to when it was cloudy outside. That fits the sermon a little better than the sunshine. It's just a cloudy, cloudy day. This morning we're going to attempt to kind of couch our message this morning around two altars. Because I think in a lot of ways, we all are kind of confronted with two altars. And I was a little unsure of how to represent two altars. I felt like you needed like the stone platform, but we didn't have any of those things. So I reached in my office. If you've been in my office, you know I have a lot of different stuff. It's kind of cool because the mic works even if I'm not in there. Isn't that weird? So, not to brag or anything, but these are the 2017 Westerville Rec Tournament Champion trophy. I was a coach. We didn't repeat, but we had the 2018 runner-up trophy. So, I don't know what else either. So we have these kind of two altars, right? And I think in a lot of ways, our lives are always kind of confronted between two altars. Because on the one altar is the altar that God is in charge. And God is the boss. And what God says goes. And it's the side of faithfulness and belief and confidence. And it's the days that you wake up and you say, I know that God is here and I know God is in charge and I know God knows what's best for my life. But then there's the other days. Maybe I should do it the other way around. The bigger trophy, okay. So the bigger trophy is God's, right? Okay. But there's this other altar that we're always, that's the altar of questioning. It's the altar that everybody else is throwing stuff at you from outside of God's people saying, are you buying into all that stuff? It's when you watch the news and you see all the negative things happen and you start to go, I'm not sure. I don't know. And I think on top of this altar is a lot of different things for a lot of different people. I know the other altar. I know that's Yahweh's altar. But on the other altar is a lot of different things. For some people, it's power. For some people, it's wealth. For some people, it's sports. For some people, it's talents. For some people, it could be anything. But all those things begin to kind of pull us away from the God that says, I'm in charge of things. It's really, when you boil down our faith and you boil down what Christianity really is, it's this. It's being confronted with two choices. It's Mary Beth read from Joshua. I threw you off. You all thought, oh, Joshua's our guy today. We'll get to Joshua later. It's the same thing that Joshua presents the nation of Israel. You remember the book of Joshua? He leads the people into the promised land. They get to the end of Joshua's life. They have all this great thing behind them. This wonderful thing. This is the promised land that they've been waiting for generations. And Joshua basically stands up before him and he says this. He says, you've got two choices. You can serve God, but if serving God is undesirable to you, then you choose who you want to serve. You can serve the gods of the people you're living in. You can serve the gods that your ancestors served. But you have to make a choice. This morning, we're going to talk about the choice that we have to make. And we're going to talk about someone who had to make very much a choice between two altars. Very literal altars. And perhaps you've noticed, or perhaps you haven't, there's a lot of miracles and kind of supernatural things that happen in the Bible. But when you really study that, most of those things happen in three periods of time, fairly short periods of time. They're very concentrated in when they happen. And a lot of people have kind of noticed that there are three different time periods in the Bible where there's just a lot of spectacular, unusual things that happen. The first time that happens is in the life of Moses. You're probably familiar with a lot of the things that happened in Moses' life. Remember, he hears the burning bush talking. He throws his staff down, it becomes a snake, and then it becomes a staff again. He goes in before Pharaoh, and there's the plagues. And so all of these things are concentrated in a fairly small time, and they're all kind of associated with Moses. That's one period of time. The second period of time is one that we're most familiar with, and that, of course, is during Jesus' lifetime. There's lots and lots of miracles that take place. Walking on water, turning water to wine, feeding 5,000, and on we could go. Pick your favorite miracle. But they all take place in a decade, 5 years, 6 years. A fairly concentrated time period. Just like with Moses, a fairly concentrated time period. And I think if I had asked any of you to come up and kind of recite to us the life of Moses and some of the things that happened in his life, I think most of you could probably, kind of conjure up most of what that was. But there's one period of time that we often neglect to talk about when we think of big miraculous times. We probably aren't even maybe thinking about it in that way. There's other miracles that happen kind of scattered here or there, but most of them take place during the life of Moses, during the life of Christ, and interestingly, during the life of Elijah. We don't often think about Elijah on kind of equal footing with Moses, and clearly not Jesus. And I want to talk for a few minutes about, I think Elijah has kind of lost his allure in the church today. We don't really think about Elijah on these lofty terms. But when Jesus goes to the Mount of Transfiguration, who's there? Moses and Elijah. Elijah casts such a shadow over the people that when Jesus came along, remember, he asked his disciples, hey, who do people think that I am? And a lot of people said, we think he's Elijah. Like, that's how big of a deal Elijah was that years later, centuries later, they, you know, he goes off into the chariot and doesn't die, and so people were expecting him to come back. And so Elijah has quite a bit of clout at the time. And yet, when we talk about Elijah today, we're just not overly familiar with Elijah. Let's remind ourselves a little bit before we get to the great battle for the trophy between the two altars. That'll be kind of the great climax. Let's remember the journey that we find with Elijah. It all starts with a drought. 1 Kings chapter 17. Elijah, who was from Tishbe in Gilead, told King Ahab. Now, the first thing that's interesting about this is Elijah. I just spent like 5 minutes trying to convince you that Elijah was a big deal. When he shows up in the Bible, we don't know anything about him. Like, remember those time periods, Moses's and Jesus's? We know all kinds of stuff about Jesus. John the Baptist was preparing the way. Every Christmas, we celebrate everything about the lead up to Christ. Even Moses, there's a big story about how he came on the scene. Remember, they were killing all the babies, and he was in the water and ended up in Pharaoh's house. But with Elijah, 1 Kings 17 just says, oh, there's a guy named Elijah. We know where he's from, but we don't know his people. We don't know anything about him, really. All we know is that he talked to the king, King Ahab. As surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, the God I serve, there will be no dew or rain during the next few years until I give the word. And the Lord said to Elijah, go to the east and hide by the Kirith Brook, which is a wadi. You know what a wadi is. You have them in California, these big, wide kind of creeks. They're always dry, but during the rainy seasons, they fill up with water. God tells Elijah to go to the wadi there, at Kirith, east of the Jordan. The ravens brought him bread and meat every morning and every evening, and he drank from the brook. But after a while, the brook dried up, for there was no rainfall anywhere in the land. Elijah has one of these kind of inauspicious beginnings. We don't know anything about him. He shows up, he gives a message to the king that, hey, we're going to have a big drought. God sends him out to the boondocks to live by himself, where it's so remote that the only way he's going to get food is if these ravens bring him food. And he's got to drink out of this stream that's slowly drying up, and what comes to pass is what Elijah told the king was going to happen. It dries up. He runs out of water. Eventually, the drought caused it to dry up, and Elijah was told to move to Zarephath. Picking up in verse 8, the Lord said to Elijah, go to Zarephath near the city of Sidon. I've instructed a widow there to feed you. This is, I've made the point. Elijah is a big deal. God starts off by sending him out in the boondocks to be fed by ravens, so he goes from there. And I don't know about you, but I hate birds. Like, I hate them. The thought of eating from a bird is going to upset my stomach probably the rest of the week, just thinking about this. And now that's over. Now I've found a widow who's going to take care of you. Okay, don't have anything against widows, but in that culture, widows were pretty much assumed they were pretty impoverished. And as you know the story, she was very impoverished. He goes to Zarephath in verse 10. As he arrived at the gates of the village, he saw a widow gathering sticks and said, would you please bring me a little water in a cup? As she was going to get it, he called to her, hey, bring me a little bread too. That stopped her in her tracks. She said, I swear by the Lord your God that I don't have a single piece of bread. I've only got a little bit of flour left in a jar and a little bit of oil. I was just about to gather these sticks to cook up the last meal, and then my son and I are going to die. It's a pretty dark situation. But Elijah says to her, don't be afraid. Go ahead and do just what you've said. But make a little bread for me first, and then use what's left to prepare a meal for yourself and your son. For this is what the God of Israel says, there will always be flour and olive oil left in your containers until the time that the Lord sends rain and the crops grow again. And so she did as Elijah said, and she and Elijah and her family continued to eat for many days. There was always enough flour and olive oil in the containers, just as the Lord had promised through Elijah. Sometime later, the woman's son became sick, maybe because he was eating little dough balls for a long time, and that's all there was, barely enough to get by. He got worse and worse, and he finally died. Then she said to Elijah, "Oh man of God, what have you done to me? Have you come all the way here to point out my sins and then kill my son?" But Elijah replied. Remember, Elijah had began this whole relationship by basically asking her to trust him. But Elijah replied, "Give me your son." And he took the child's body from her arms, carried him up the stairs to the room where he was staying, and laid the body on his bed. Then Elijah cried out to the Lord, "Oh Lord my God, why have you brought tragedy to this widow who has opened her home for me, causing her son to die?" And he stretched himself out over the child 3 times and cried out to the Lord, "Oh Lord my God, please let this child's life return to him." The Lord heard Elijah's prayer, and the life of the child returned and he revived. And then Elijah brought him down from the upper room and gave him to his mother. "Look," he said, "your son is alive." And then the woman told Elijah, "Now I know for sure that you're a man of God, and that the Lord speaks through you." Now, God is preparing Elijah for his big moment. But it doesn't seem like it, does it? I mean, if I was preparing you for the biggest moment of your life, and I said, "Okay, I want you to eat as little as possible. As a matter of fact, I'm going to send birds to you to feed you. And then you're going to go live with a widow and her son and barely stay alive." Yeah, there was always enough oil, there was always enough flour, but I'm guessing they weren't having these big pizza doughs every night, right? They're just enough to get by, preparing for the big moment. And what's amazing is that the next thing we learn is that God comes to Elijah and says, "Now I want you to go to the king." And if you're reading it through Elijah's perspective, we have to say, how can he be ready to face the king? He's been eating dough balls for years and bird food. There's nothing about this that seems like God is preparing him. And you see how, when you look at the altars that your choice, you're forced to choose between, there are times when choosing God's altar doesn't look like it makes a lot of sense. It's certainly not always the easiest thing to do, to choose to live our lives according to God. So Obadiah, who was sent by Ahab to find Elijah, went to Ahab and told him that Elijah had come. Ahab went out to meet Elijah, and so you have the king of Israel. Remember, this is during a drought. It's a difficult circumstance. The king is grouchy because he's used to having his big meal. There's not a lot going on. And he greets him by saying, "Is it really you, you troublemaker of Israel?" Remember, he's the one that told him it was going to have a drought in the first place. "What in the world is going on? Why are you before me?" the king asks him. And Elijah speaks truth to him. He said, "I haven't brought any trouble to you. I haven't brought anything. You and your family are the troublemakers." Imagine that. This is his big moment. He's standing before the king. Tells him right to his face, "You're the troublemaker." Knees are probably banging together because he's terrified of what he's saying. Oftentimes, God's people have to confront the powers that be. Happens over and over again. Moses confronts Pharaoh. Elijah before the king. Jesus constantly battles them. And so Elijah lays down the gauntlet for King Ahab. He tells him, "You and your family are the troublemakers, for you have refused to obey the commandments of the Lord." You're worshiping at the wrong altar, he tells them. "I want you to get all of Israel to join me on Mount Carmel, along with the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who were supported by Jezebel, the king's wife, queen. So imagine the scene. You have Elijah on his own standing up to the king saying, "You have all these false gods. Why don't you bring them out and let's have a showdown on Mount Carmel?" 1 versus 850. My math is correct. What's interesting is I'm reading from the New Living Translation. Really, the more literal translation about these prophets, it says that they were supported by Jezreel. That's what the New Living Translation. But the more literal translation says, "those who eat at Jezebel's table." And so not only do we have this contrast of which altar they're serving at, but you have the preparation where Elijah, we know, has been kind of living at the poverty line. He's not been cushioned at all. These prophets, they've been fed by a queen. They've had a comfortable life. They're confident. They're cocky. They know that their God is going to do what happens. And so you remember the scene, right? It's one of the most visual, incredible scenes in the whole Bible. The two altars are there. Elijah says, all right, let's just see who can call down fire first from heaven. You cry out to your gods, I'm going to cry out to Yahweh God. The first one to make it happen clearly has spoken to the nation of Israel. And so the prophets begin to do their dances and their whatever it is that they did, trying to cry out over and over again, asking their gods, Baal and Asherah and anybody else, trying to get them to something to happen. And if it sounds like a funny scene, it is. It's hilarious. All these righteous people that have all the backing of the government, all the backing of the king and queen, knowing their life is really on the line in a lot of ways. And so they begin, it says in verse 28, they shouted louder, following their normal custom. They cut themselves with knives and swords until blood gushed out. They raved all afternoon until the evening sacrifice, but still there was no sound, there was no response. And Elijah is loving it. Like, he's a little bit off whack. He's kind of a goofy guy here. You have all these prophets going crazy, and he's just standing with his arms crossed, practically cracking up. And what I love, it's like one of the few times in the Bible, he starts making fun of them. Hey, maybe you're not yelling loud enough. Maybe you should, I mean, you can just see them going through hours and hours, and they're so frustrated because they expect something to happen. And Elijah's just living it up. He's just mocking them like crazy. That's an incredible faith. Incredible faith. Because when Ray Thomas is coaching football, he's like, look, if you're going to go out there and be confident, you better back it up with your play. If there was a guy that needed to back it up, Elijah, you can see anybody who was silently rooting for Elijah, when he started making fun of the prophets, they all backed up like, I'm out now, man. This is all on this guy. And then I love what happens. It's like one of the greatest moments of the Bible. Elijah goes, hey, you know what? Let's put water on it. He starts, before he does that, though, it's kind of an amazing thing. He takes his altar, and he takes 12 stones, 12 rocks, and he kind of rebuilds the altar. Remember that God was not worshipped in those days. And so he's reconstructing the altar to Yahweh. 12 stones representing each one of the tribes of Israel, which was probably there. And he builds it up, and he takes it, and he builds this kind of trough around the altar. And he says, what the heck? Let's put water on it. So he gets 4 big jars, and they come, and they just pour water all over the meat that he put there and the logs. Do it again. They go, and there's water dripping everywhere. Do it again. 3 times. There's so much water on it that the trough that they built around the altar is full. And anybody who knows anything knows there's no way that's going to catch on fire. I don't care if he's got matches, which I don't think were invented then. I don't care if he's got a torch from a neighboring tribe. There's no way that will light up. And it really, truly is one of the great moments of the Bible. Did you notice that little clause at the end of the reading? All these false prophets are carrying on until it was the time of the sacrifice in the evening. They didn't even know because nobody had been worshiping or following the book of the law. Nobody had been worshiping God properly. Elijah knew it was time for the evening sacrifice. Elijah chooses that moment to say this. Oh God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, prove today that you're the God in Israel and that I am your servant. Prove that I have done all this at your command. This is not about me. Oh Lord, answer me. Answer me so these people will know that you, oh Lord, are God and you have brought them back to yourself. The New Living Translation says in verse 38, immediately, the fire of the Lord flashed down from heaven and burned up the young bull, the wood, the stones, and the dust. It wasn't a little spark. It wasn't a little flint. It just burst out and it even licked up all the water in the trench. You didn't know better. You'd think they were pouring gasoline on it instead of water. And when all the people saw it, they fell face down on the ground and they cried out, the Lord, He is God. Yes, the Lord is God. I mean, if we really could put ourselves in that story, there aren't many more that are more dramatic than that one. And if we could picture ourselves caught between those two altars. I'm telling you, that's the picture that we all confront. We all face the choice between those two altars. Do we worship God, or do we just say, it's too difficult? I don't necessarily believe it. Whether you're caught up in current events and think that that's too much, or maybe it's just in your own personal life that there's too much going on, and you're like, no way, God has forsaken me a long time ago. One thing I've learned working for churches is people deal with a lot. You all deal with a lot. And it comes in all kinds of shapes and sizes. And most of the time, almost all the time, you didn't even see it coming. You know, it's one thing if you see it coming. Most of the time, you don't even see it coming. And those are the moments where we kind of are shaken to decide which altar are we going to worship in. We just wash our hands and say, this is too. Well, as Rob and Mark sat down all those years ago watching 1994 in review, I wonder what he would say if he looked at 2018 in review. And he was just overcome, and he's crying out to God. He's saying, God, are you really there? And he just prayed over this. He prayed over this. Listen to what he said. He felt like he began to get an answer from God. I felt in my spirit that he had replied to my prayer by saying that indeed, he was very much in control, and that the days we're living in were special times when he might just be requiring Christians to be filled with integrity and to stand up for him, just like Elijah did, particularly with the prophets. These are Elijah days. Elijah's story in the book of Kings that you can read about and see how isolated and alone he felt in the culture. But God told him to stand up and speak for him. A few weeks later, after the holidays, Rob and Mark is a worship pastor. And their church has two services. Between the two services, he got the words to a song, and he went down and he wrote them, and he began to write out the song, and he wrote the chords that go to the song. And then they went into the next service and they sang the song. What he says about this song, I think, really magnifies what we're talking about this morning. He says, how do you express the sense that these might be days, not of failure and submission, but of the sort of resilient, declaring, even arrogant trust and hope that Elijah had in his God? That he was so confident that he would mock the other prophets because he knew that his God would stand up. That these are not days of God stepping back and allowing the world and the church to just roll uncontrolled towards eternity, but rather these are days when he's calling on his body to take a stand, to offer right praises and declare that he's totally in control. As you look at our board of names up here, these are testimonies to people who have relayed to us that he's worthy of trust. I reckon you may write these words. These are the days of Elijah, and these are the days of David. I've used word pictures and biblical characters to make that expression, but it's no different from many of the other great hymn writers, and even David himself. And then he said, I presented this song to the church that day with a short word of explanation, and we sang it as our worship, and the song has lived on now for 20 years. That's the legacy of Elijah as we put him on our board. A testimony saying, these are the days where God is calling us to live like Elijah. Realizing that often at the altar of God, there's not a lot of support. If you remember the story, after Mount Carmel, Elijah goes off and he's depressed. I mean, you think after this great moment he would be full of life, but he was depressed and he felt like he was the only one there. It's what makes this song so powerful. As we sing about the days of Elijah, not individually, but together collectively as a church. You remember God came to Elijah and he says, get up, Elijah, you're not by yourself. This isn't all on your shoulders. It sure must have felt like it as he faced all those prophets on the other altar, standing there all alone, and certainly you have time for you to feel that way. As we finish this morning, I don't know what false altar or the false god is that may be beckoning your solicitation. It's beckoning you to turn your back on God. But inevitably, we all face somebody pulling us away from that. We need days like Elijah days where we can stand up and say, you know what, it doesn't look good, but my faith and trust is in God. That's what all of these people have done for us. And we live, this is us, we live in that tradition. So, as we close this morning, let's stand up and sing the song that Robin Marks sang all those, they wrote all those years ago. Let's stand and sing.